Lotus and Cross, a very famous, I think C.S. Song wrote very in the 80s, a very famous article, which is, you can find it in every theological reader book. He looked at it from a Buddhist perspective. I like to look at it from an Indian perspective. Lotus is rooted in the clay. One has to be rooted in their particularities. And when it floats according to the current. It goes up high or lower. So according to the context, we have to grow or reduce. Sometimes we have to be kenotic, empty ourselves. And at the end, you can't limit to the two world. You have to bring out sometime the flower, leap, the glory of God. You have to also learn to leap beyond your tradition and see what a glory of God, not only within our particularities, even with other particularities. If God is calling in that way, that is the diversity of mission one has to learn. But that may not be the starting point sometimes. Yeah? I think that is one of the essential things which I would like to learn from the Lotus and theology from Indian context. This is what I did for 6 years in UTC, Bangalore, in Bangalore. I have still friends who is a guru, Prabhakarji, who is a Shishya of Hari, Shri, what's his name? Shri, the famous counseling guru, he is a Shishya of that. And he teaches me all the Gita and because I learned Sanskrit, so I still learn Gita. And Good Fridays, I go to a big crowd and I talk about Hinduism from a Christian perspective, sometimes Christianity from a Hindu perspective. And also we have Muslims, some of our Muslims, we all come and share our faith. We have our own particularities, not to lose. But at the same time, we also respect others and listen. Thereby, we can find a common space there, which is not exclusive, not condemning, rather a new world to work together in educating the poor and the downtrodden. And he runs 70 schools in Karnataka, in and around Bangalore. You know, he also runs a famous program on yoga. I have attended and learned yoga from him, Lord, because it's a way of engaging with each other. That we learn, but that is my calling, but that not necessarily a grassroots level Christian calling. So in order to remove the ignorance of each other, we have to recognize each one's particularity and appreciate them. Then only people come to the table. Very often we go with the pluralistic idea, people are scattered, they don't want to come together at all, they do not want to relate. They immediately take themselves away. This is one of my emphasis, that we need to recognize and appreciate people's particularities very much. And even their contribution to the universal communities. And once we appreciate that, they come to the table and talk to each other. And also, they found a common space in spite of all this confrontation and conflict. And when they find common space, people are united from different religions, from Christianity to Hinduism, from Hinduism to Christianity, people move from Sikhism to Islam, Islam to Sikhism, Christianity to Sikhism. People, move and also learn together a lot about each other. And then once they learned it, they do not make judgment about others. And I think the common space is critical tension sometimes, just like Trinity. I think I will stop there and I will ask, leave it that for question, because Missio en Deo gives an idea that particularities are in critical tension within Trinity. That gives us a model that human beings also can grow to be mature in a level where their particularities are appreciated. And they still can tell this story to all and invite everybody. At the same time, they can also find a common space. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you. Well, thank you very, very much. You've given us a very broad sweep and picked upon a variety of different thoughts. And what's come across to me is that the theology is informed by your passion for your involvement at the grassroots. And I think that's a very interesting dynamic to explore. I wonder if I could open it out for questions and comments from you all.
One last one. I come from very almost kind of a pluralistic Christian background as well. But one of the things I've always had a challenge with is if evangelism seems to be a point of most mission, if we create this common space where we're working together for, say, the good works side of Christianity, at what point would a Christian missionary be able to work from a faith aspect? Where is that ground? Where would that ground frame swell be? What would you be trying to do? Say, if I went to India, at what point would I be able to work in a common space on faith issues instead of just works issues?
That's a good question. Shall I answer that?
Yeah.
I think, see, one of the things which C.S. Song, as a theologian, also wrote, that when people are hungry, the theology is a bowl of rice. It's their theology, you see. So it's quite interesting to listen to, because, see, when people are having this conflict and misunderstanding between them because of ignorance, even evangelism, the good news, is to eliminate the ignorance. Not my own doctrine. It will fuel it further. Isn't it? That's what I said. You know, the exclusive claim sometimes has created more ignorance about Christianity than really enabled people to do the mission. That's why you also use the word, martyria, witnessing. Witnessing is an essential element of mission. You know, so evangelism is to announce the good news. So if you do not take the context and people seriously, what we announce as good news may not be good news for them. Sometimes doctrines and other things. You know, so in that exclusive claim, sometimes what happens is that blocks what we are already witnessing for 40 years. And it makes people not to come to school. So only when you create a space between Christians and Hindus and Muslims, there is the space for you to show God's love ultimately. That is, and you announce the liberation of the Dalits and liberation of the oppressed. That is the good news announcing. So that is part and parcel of Christian evangelism. You know, missionaries, when they came to my place, they touched the untouchables. They did not proclaim. When they touched the untouchable, many of them became automatically Christians, even without knowing what is Christianity. You see? So evangelism does not mean that only proclamation. This is more to do with our Protestant idea of equating, word-centric Christianity. You see, we have forgotten the art part of it, aesthetic side of it. You know, so it is essential, I can understand, where they can interpret their own action together and how much they can witness. You know, I can give you an example of mentally challenged children where we work together. Whenever we went to the school, it's a secular school. You know, I took a pastor with me, and he would always insist that we start before anything we do with the prayer. Okay? So, you know, for him, he came because his intention is to convert them to Christianity. Okay? But for our intention is to train them to the young people, mentally challenged young people, to be kind of what they call it, the call center workers. You see, so they cannot read, make sentence properly. So what we do is we only play with icons in the computers, and we train them to be kind of, convert the Word document into PDF files or convert them into a printable files. And then they can also listen to some people and answer their calls, you know, they provide services. You know, that's the kind of call center training we gave. But our intention is to relate to the young people and through them, beyond them, a big community. But the pastor's intention is always to evangelize them. But then once we establish the trust and the relationship, that our intention is not necessarily that we are here to convert everybody, they provide a space for us. And they had, you know, asked the padri to stand before a Kali temple, Hindu temple, and preach. He preached for 1 hour. You see, before a Kali temple. So it is challenging for him. He cannot think about preaching before Kali temple, but he was given a chance there to preach. You see? So there is a space created once the trust is established. At the same time, you must be also be open enough that they are also having a calling on their own. So you must also be ready to listen to them when they want to tell you their story, faith story. But they, once you give them the space, they would also give you a space. And there you can talk, you can share your own faith story. People may come and accept Christ. And I think the conversion creates a tension there. You know, I think conversion is also under question sometimes, because very often Christians are hypocrites in converting people through various means that I should accept. You know, they were very, very much used other means, not Christian means. You see, so now we are calling for Christian means. So in that one, we do not need a hidden agenda there. We do not need to, trumpet, or we do not need to be, you know, kind of playing as a power game of the Christendom. You know, we are powerless today. We just come with love, and we are free to invite people as well if they want to accept. And then Hindus understand that, you see. And Hindus are not apostate. Even in the RSS, they made it very clear. Even when they brought an act in Gujarat, in Tamil Nadu, in Rajasthan, they made it very clear. They were included four words. One is allurement, force, and threat, and also strong persuasion. You see, strong persuasion can be, you know, subjectively interpreted. But the allurement and force and also threat. These three things they didn't want. Otherwise, you can convert. That's what they said. Yeah.
These three things you mentioned, how much is it an RSS fantasy, or how much is it really the case? People are being allured and forced and threatened.
Yeah, that's a good question, because when the RSS used the word threat, is used, they gave an example, like they immediately go to the Goan's history or Portuguese. You see, then they would also go to Mizoram, which is 99% Christians. When North Indians go there, you know, they are forced to wear cross, you know, if you want to work in Mizoram. So they will use this kind of examples, of selected examples. But I think that can be subjectively interpreted. I can understand that. Yeah, threat. But allurement, I think very often allurement has been used in many Christian institutions, unfortunately. Even because as a priest, as a, you know, a kind of managed schools, we encourage students who are given scholarship to attend chapel. No, it's not expected also. We have moved from compulsory to expected also. We have moved it, but we encourage. So in that sense, it's still allurement works. So that is, it's more with the Catholic institution also it works, unfortunately. Yeah, so we have to repent. Christianity has to repent for using wrong means of conversion, which is against Christian mission, I suppose.
Jesse.
Could you talk about how to decide? While I'm listening to you, unity is important, but I'm struck by how in the history of just Christianity alone, not to mention Christianity's relationships with other faiths, how often unity has not been achieved. And how often there have been things that have divided Christianity. And so what sort of guidance do we have for deciding what are sort of the important particulars of Christianity? And, I mean, you mentioned Hooker, and Hooker talked about the adiaphora, you know, the things that are less important, that aren't essential. Because it sure seems like, just in when I'm in ecumenical conversations, that unity is really hard to achieve, just in that. So how do we move towards a universality in a multi-faith setting? How do we know what's core and what's not core?
Okay. I think, yeah, if I understood you correctly, what is core and what is not core? I'm interested in what is core according to my own faith. Yeah, what I am grown up with. Yeah, I'm struggling to understand it in its core forms. You see, at the end of the day, I have four Gospels, not one Gospel. It's quite interesting, the early Christians resisted synchronizing the whole thing. So within my own discovery, I find the limitations of still finding what is my core faith, what is my core Gospel, you see. But at the same time, I strongly believe that I have got something to give to this world, is it not? That is one thing that I have. But when you come for unity as such, these traditions, when different traditions comes, why Pentecostals strongly believe, and I heard some of my students telling that the Catholics are not Christians, you see. I had postgraduate students who are teaching in the Pentecostal seminary now in India, and they would say this openly. And whereas the Orthodox Church in India, they would say Pentecostals are stealing our sheep. They use this common phrase, is it not? So, you know, this kind of whole, you know, that confrontational attitude is there within Christianity. Yeah? And to be also frank, that Pentecostal now has become an inevitable movement in India. It has grown in large numbers. And so, what happens, how do we come to unity? I do not think unity is anything at all possible as we were united in 1947 between Pentecostals and the Church of South India and the Catholic Church. Unity is not possible at all. But how we can work together in some spaces without fighting each other? That is my question. So in order to do that, we have to create a space where we can reduce the ignorance about each other. You want to challenge the Pentecostals not to steal the sheep. If you really work into their own faith, they would claim many of them are converts, you know, from other religions. Maybe a few Christians might have gone, or maybe more Christians might have gone in some particular regions, and whereas in some other regions it might not have. So when we come together, it helps us to reduce the ignorance between ourselves, and then we find a common space. And then we also find a space to work together, and World Vision helped me in that regard, because World Vision worked through the charismatic groups and the Pentecostals, so they used to invite me to do work with them. Even though the Pentecostal pastors, they knew that I am from Church of South India, established church, they always allowed me to talk to them about the HIV/AIDS and other things. So we found a space together beyond this reducing ignorance to work together. So when you work together, you bring your own interpretation into the work. You know, that sometimes we find collision, sometimes, you know, overlapping, sometimes it's helpful to understand each other, you know, so it helps us to create a trust, and that helps us to go further, even not to be united and merge into one church, because people do not want to lose their identity. Pentecostalism, once it becomes part of a particular church, it loses its identity, so they do not want to be like that, and the Catholic Church as well. Yeah. So in that sense, we can find a unity in our own distinctions, by holding our own distinction, but through this common space, not necessarily a uniformity that doesn't bring us to uniformity at all. Maybe it may happen in some radical years, like, you know, when independence happened, people all wanted to come together and become a church. And the same thing with Pakistan church as well. It may happen at one point of time, we may be open for that, because sometime now, Pentecostals also have bishops in India, you know, and I do not think we should seek beyond that that common space of working together and witnessing together, you know, in a way where we may share each other and nourish each other, correct each other also. When we are open for that, some of the things I found when I wrote a big book on theological education, I found when I was editing, when I was reading the Orthodox theologians in Africa, in Russia, and also Pentecostals in Russia, it's quite an interesting contrast. So I felt if they come together, they mutually may nourish and educate and correct each other, you know, at that trust level, without losing their own particularities. Yeah, that's my thing. And so, in that sense, I think unity has to be defined a little bit differently rather than becoming uniformity. Yeah, that's what I was struggling. I hope, you know, it's a kind of space I'm talking about, common space, yeah? Yeah.
The kind of unity you're talking about, you mentioned world vision. This is just a factual information. World vision, I'm an Orthodox, not from India, but sort of from Anglicanism, I became Orthodox. And they have funded a project which the Orthodox Institute in Cambridge has been working on, a course of basic Christianity, evangelical outreach or talks. They have actually funded for us to produce this on a DVD box set and CD and all the things. Without it, it would not have been possible. But the idea was to make it available for the Eastern European countries because it's been translated. And they are working with the local churches, which is Orthodox in these countries. But it's an interesting example, another example of this kind of cooperation you're talking about. But my questions concern two other things. Just, I would like some explanation. What do you mean by the critical tension in the Trinity? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me as an Orthodox to talk about a critical tension within the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
It does make sense in human terms
as
a model of the Trinity, because we are steeped in our passions and sin and so on, so we're going to have tension. But it doesn't make sense to me to talk about critical tension in the Trinity. Why do you use that phrase?
Yeah, I think that's, you raised me, this is a, it's again Orthodox write-up, theosis, deification of in Christian theology. And this is written by a Russian Orthodox, and Stephen Finland is a book. It's a quite a, you know, if you read these books, I think particularly Veli Matti Kaikkonen, he also has written even up to Pentecostal, how they are influenced by theosis. They both of them are highlighting the struggles of this difference between the different triune gods there. Critical tension, I mean that when Jesus brings his humanity in Godhood, that is not simply, you know, a kind of it is not a smooth transition, is it? It brings its own critical tension within Godhood, I suppose. I am writing an interesting book, Theology and Media, where also I highlight this issue. I let me use the metaphors rather than into Trinity. Metaphors in Job chapter 1, you know, where I use Carl Jung as a kind of idea. I have written this in Journal for Ecumenical Studies last year, where I found an interesting word that, as usual, the Satan appeared in the Parliament of God. Use the word the Parliament of God, you know. And Carl Jung used this archetype as an opposite within. You know, that's quite a interesting thing in God consciousness. Its archetype of God cannot be imagined without imagining along with it the opposite. You know, that's what Carl Jung. But I say it's a generosity of God to allow the Satan within the God's community, that it, his voices are heard every day. And if you really look at that, how the tension emerges between God and it's a story to think about, how the tension emerges between the Satan and God voices. And in the similar way, I can give you more examples. I think I have evolved in that book. In a similar way, when humanhood comes into Godhood, I think one of the tension I would feel, it's revealed to Peter in his own dreams. You know, what I have made clean is no more unclean. You know, that itself is a tension there.